Before starting, I just wanted to mention that tonight, both Abe and I have yahrzeits. Abe, your yahrzeit is for
my father.
Your father, and I also have for my father. Your father was Rav Moshe Rafael Ben
Yitzchak HaKohen.
Yitzchak HaKohen.
Avraham Yitzchak.
What?
Avraham Yitzchak.
Avraham Yitzchak. Oh, okay. Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen. And my father's name here is at the bottom of the page, Rav Asher Aaron Ben Avraham Binyamin. And so we are dedicating this to their memory. And I want to take a look at, Parsha Pinchas is lots of stuff. Obviously, the second half of Parsha Pinchas is all the Parsha of Tzmidin and Musafin. We have, just before that, the investiture of Yehoshua. Just before that, we have the whole story with Benot Tzlofchad. And before that, of course, the very long census, which is far more intriguing than meets the eye. And there's a lot of details in there that are somewhat strange. And that open up the doors to a lot of interesting parshanut. But I want to go to the beginning of the parasha, which is the story of Pinchas' zealotry, which suffers in, as one of my teachers once called it, it suffers from the cholent problem. And that is that the story of Pinchas really stretches over two parshiot, the end of Balak into the beginning of Pinchas. Of course, what happens is, so last Shabbat, we finished Parshat Balak, and we went home, and we had cholent, we took a nap, and then we came to Shul to Mincha, and by the time we hear Pinchas, we don't necessarily make the connection. So it's important to read the story as a unit. And that's what we have in front of us here, which is essentially the entire chapter 25, which after Pasuk Tet is the end of Parshat Balak, and so, but we're going to read it straight through. And I point out along the way some very strange things that happen here. You know, when we think about who are our enemies in this interaction, and I'll gild that one a little bit by pointing out that in the aftermath of this action, we are told to go to war against one of them, and the other one gets off scot-free. And who are we told to go to war against?
Midian.
And yet, as you'll see, that's a strange choice. So let's take a look at the story. Vayeshu Yisrael Bashitim. I saw a parenthetic note that was interesting, is the email with the source sheets got flagged by different filters for bad language, because I have a translation here, and you look at the first line in the translation, and maybe you can see why. Interesting. Anyhow, Vayeshu Yisrael Bashitim Vayachal Am Liznot El Benot Moab. All right, so Bnei Israel are in Shittim. Shittim is right on the other side of the Jordan. It is underneath the mountains of Moab. And the people start having znut with the daughters of Moab. Now, why are they having znut with the daughters of Moab? Because they're hanging around there. The daughters of Moab are available. So they do that. And so the daughters of Moab seduce the men to come and bow and worship to their God. Now, who's the God of Moab? The God of Moab is Kamosh. We find it throughout, already in Chumash, and we find it throughout Tanakh. So that makes this next piece a little bit odd. Vayitzamid Yisrael Leval Peor. So the particular worship that they're involved with here is not Kamosh, but rather it's something called Baal Peor. Now, what's Baal Peor? So there's a famous Midrash, which is that Peor is the same word as Poer, and Poer is to open up wide. And it's called Baal Peor because the form of worship is you open up wide, but it's not your mouth. It's the other side, and you defecate. And that's the way the worship happens. And even halachically, we have a category called Poer le Peor, or Zorek Evan le Markulis, which is that Avodah Zarah, generally you're not liable if you do a degrading act to a foreign god, unless that's the way that foreign god is worshipped. And therefore, halachically, if you throw a stone at Mercury, it's not really throwing a stone, it's laying a stone. Or if you're Po'er to Baal Po'er, you're Chayav. Now, by the time that halacha is formulated, Baal Po'er is ancient history. And I'll show you later on that that Midrash is delightful Midrash, but and it's part of the general agenda that Tanakh and the Baalei Midrash have of doing everything to ridicule Avodah Zarah, but it actually doesn't hold water, as you'll see. But in any case, they worship Baal Peor, Echraf Adonai be Israel, and God gets angry. And now what you're going to see, three steps here that don't hang together. So Hashem tells Moshe, take the leaders of the people and essentially impale them before God, and God's anger will subside, which itself is an odd command, but Moshe doesn't do it. So Moshe speaks to what we think is Rashi Am, and instead of impaling them, he speaks to them and says, "Here, gu ishan ashav hanitzmadim leval peor." So the simplest read of this kind of confusion is that the way Moshe understood the command was, take the leaders and have the leaders punish their own followers, meaning have representatives of the different tribes and clans and have them each punish their own followers. And that's here, gu ish anashav, the ones who are worshiping Baal Peor. And now, vihine, ish mibnei Yisrael ba, vayakrev alachavetam midyanit. So a man from Bnei Yisrael shows up. We'll find out in a little bit what his name is. And he brings a Midyanit. Now, the Midyanim were not part of the story till now. And everybody's weeping. Why are they weeping? They're paralyzed. They're paralyzed because Am Yisrael is doing this. A lot of members of Bnei Yisrael are doing this foreign worship. And evidently, there's some sort of an either action by the leaders or else some sort of play going on, as we'll find out. And Moshe and the leaders seem to be paralyzed. Now, what happens? We don't know what this guy is doing with this Midianite girl yet. Vayar Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aharon HaKohen. Now, notice that Pinchas is the guy who we've met him before. We met him all the way back in Shemot, and we know that his father is Elazar. But we haven't really heard much about him yet. And he's introduced, but he's introduced in an unusual fashion. Normally, when we meet somebody, we meet them by their name and their patronym, maybe by their tribe, maybe by their livelihood, depends on the context, but not usually two generations. But here it's Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aharon HaKohen, and we're going to see that repeat. So he gets up and he takes a lance. So the simplest read of this, like many of them Farshim read, is he came to the man into the private room that he was in, Vayid Koret Shnehem, and he stabbed the two of them. Et Ish Yisrael v'Taishal Kovata. He staked the man and the woman El Kovata. There is also a midrash that Kava means their stomach and that they were right through, and there's a Midrash that's quoted in Masachat Sanhedrin that he poked through both of them and they picked them up and carried them in, both skewered. But simple pshat is that he went into this private room where they were, and the assumption here, and we're going to see it confirmed, is that the two of them were involved in having relations, and he slaughtered them. And now the plague stopped. So what plague was there? So we either have to assume that there was some sort of plague going on that we did not hear about before, and that means that there's now three different actions going on. God says to Moshe, string up the leaders. Moshe tells the leaders, kill your men. In the meantime, there's a plague, unless we want to bring them all together, and I'll suggest that later on. In the meantime, we get a count, as we do at the end of every one of these things. We got it after the Egel. We got it after Korach. We get it here, too. We find out that 24,000 people died in this plague. Parenthetically, the census that comes right afterwards gives us a little bit of a hint about this plague, because even though the census, quite miraculously, comes out to nearly the same amount of fighting men, a little over 600,000, but the individual tallies vary, and certain tribes grew and certain tribes shrunk. And the tribe that got it worst was Shevet Shimon. They went down to 22,000 people from somewhere in the 50s. And so the notion is that these 24,000 people may have been, a large chunk of them, or maybe all of them, were from Shevet Shimon. And why do we think that? Because of the following. By the Ber Adonai Moshe Limor, and this is after the Cholent. Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aharon HaKohen, Nochamo. Heshivet chamatim al bnei so b'kanor kinati b'tocham. He's the one who acted zealously on my behalf. right? And I did not destroy Bnei Israel in my anger. I'm going to give him a brit shalom. Now, we're familiar with the Midrash that Pinchas himself was not a Kohen because the Kohanim were Aharon and his sons and any children they would have afterwards. Pinchas was born earlier, as we see in Shemot. And therefore, Pinchas is now being elevated to Kuna. That may be the brit that we read here by Talol Zaroch Rav, brit Kuna Tolam. On the other hand, there may be a different thing going on. What's the brit shalom that he gets? So the simplest explanation is that I'm going to protect him because he just angered a whole lot of people, members of a tribe, because he killed one of the tribal leaders. And he acted with an ex parte, he acted without having the mandate of Moshe to do so. He acted on his own. So the halacha we call Kanein Pogimbo. And this is akin to what Hashem says to Avram after Avram defeats the four kings, or at least successfully gets the hostages away from the four kings, Anochi Magen Lach, I'll protect you. The same kind of thing here. I'm going to protect you. And maybe what that means is that even though you killed somebody, you retain Brit Kunat Olam. Because after all, we know that the Kohanim's job is to preserve life. Hence, when a Kohen Gadol dies, people get to leave the Ir Miklat. And hence, a Kohen Gadol is not allowed to have any contact with death. And hence, a Kohen who murders somebody cannot serve in Avodah, cannot do Berchat Kohanim. So perhaps that's the notion here, that because this, even though he killed somebody, he did it and saved lives. So in this case, he maintains his Kuna or earns the Kuna. Tachad Asher Kinei Elohav Echaper Al Bnei Yisrael. And I'm looking at specifically Partani points in this story that are a little troubling. But to get to the bigger question, we find out that the guy who was killed with the Midianite girl was a leader of Shimon, one of the heads of the households. Right? In the headlines again today, if you noticed it, but Cosby, it's always a little fun if you're a fan of Cosby, is that the name of the Midianite girl is Cosby Vatsur. Why is that important? Because Rosh Umot Beitav Midianhu. This isn't some streetwalker girl. This is a princess who evidently made herself available to or seduced this head of one of the Shimoni families. And now we get the identity of both of them. Now, the identity of the Shimon head, we need to know. That explains the census. Why do we need to know her name? Because it's telling us something that's going on. It's not just a bunch of Benot Moav. Here it's a Midani princess who makes herself available. You would think that would be below her. So we have to keep that in mind as we read the next piece. Make enemies. Have enmity towards the Midianim. Now, by the way, in this story, who are the girls who Bnei Israel are sinning with? Who are the girls who are getting Bnei Israel to worship Peor? They're Benot Moav. And yet, there's this one Midiani girl, and now we have to go to war against the Midianim, and watch the thing. They were your enemies because they set traps for you about this Baal Peor. And the thing with Kozbi. So why is Minyan getting it? And more critically, why is Moab getting off the hook here? It's very strange. Now, parenthetically, I mentioned about Peor and the name Peor. So I just want to show you one quick thing about the Midrashic play on it. The word Peor, the verb Peor, pay ayin resh, to open something wide, is a Hebrew word. On the other hand, Peor is a local word. And you find that Peor is the name of a place. It's one of the places that Balak took Bilam to. It's actually where Moshe was buried, Beit Peor. It's in the territory of Reuven, as you see in Source 4, Beit Peor. And in Hosea, there's a mention of Baal Peor. But Beit Peor is a place. Peor is a mountain. Baal Peor seems the Baal, whose shrine is up on that mountain. Now, parenthetically, you look at Beit Peor here, and you see that the Greek transliteration of Beit Peor is Beith Fogor. In other words, they read the ayin as a gimel, and you see it also in the footnote in our pasuk, Tobel Fogor, which means that the word po'er, which is with a soft ayin, and the word pa'or, which is with a hard ayin, aren't the same word at all. But for midrashic purposes, that's totally fine. That's just a side point. My main thing that I want to get to is this. Why are Benot Moav let off the hook, right? And then we're going to read a little later that the reason that we're not allowed to let a Moavi marry a marry in is because of the lack of hospitality, etc. We're going to see that here, but not about this, not about this whole incident, right? And you see the questions here. And again, with the tip of the hat to Jason. So what happens in after, when you get to Parshat Matot, and after we've done the whole count, the census and the Tmidin, et cetera, we come to Matot, and this is going to be the last action Moshe Rabbeinu is supposed to take, which is, Nikom Nikmat B'nei Yisrael Me'etam Midyanim. Take vengeance from the Midyanim. And then, Achar Teseh Falamecha, and then you will be gathered, you people, then you're going to die. And now, by the Hashem says to Moshe, this is Nikmat B'nei Yisrael. It's a very beautiful Anida Dodiva Dodi Limum Tir. But the Bar Moshe Alam, Lemor, Chatsuni B'chem, Hashim Latzavah, V'yu Al Midyan, Latate Nikmat Adonai B'midyan. God calls it the vengeance of B'nei Yisrael, and Moshe calls it the vengeance of Hashem. It's a beautiful statement that Hashem says, you offended my relationship with you guys. That means they hurt you. And so I want you to take vengeance. And B'nai Yisrael say, they hurt our relationship with you. It's the vengeance for God. It's a beautiful thing. Anyways, in other words, there's representative soldiers from each Shevet are going to go out, which means that there's something ceremonial about this war, not just tactical. It sounds like there's 12,000. And who does he send with them? Pinchas ben Elazar, bloop HaKohen. Why do I say bloop? Because what's missing? There's no Ben Aharon here. Here it's Pinchas ben Elazar. But in the story that we read about the about Pinchas's famous zealous act and about the reward given to him, he's called Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aharon HaKohen. Right? So we have to see why that name changes. All right, and he goes out to war, and they go to war against Midian, and watch what happens in Pasuk Chet. That Malchem Midian hargu al chalaleihem, along with all the other corpses, they killed the five Midiani kings. Why are there five kings? Et Aviv, et Rechem, et Sur, et Chur, et Reva, chameshet Malchem Midian. Now, I'm going to take a page from the Haggadah in a second. Veit Bilam ben Bor hargu b'charev is something we dealt with a couple of years ago. Not going to focus on that here. Notice the order of the names, Evi, Rechem, Tzur, Chur, and Reva. What does that tell you about these five kings? So I'm going to take you back to the very famous story that happened in Bnei Brak. What was the story in Bnei Brak that we mentioned in the Haggadah? Maaseh be Rabbi Eliezer, ve next Rabbi Yoshua, the order matters. Rabbi Yoshua, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, Rabbi Tarfon, Rabbi Akiva. That's the order. Why is that order important? Because you might think it's going by age order. Eliezer is the oldest. Not exactly true. You might think it's going by hosting order, but that's not true because Eliezer is from Lod and Rabbi Yeshua is from Pekin. It seems that the order we're looking at is an order, if you would look around the table from left to right, so where's the most important person sitting? He's sitting in the middle. And you have Rabbi Eliezer, Meshua. In the middle is Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, the Nasi. And then Rabbi Tarfon, Rabbi Kiva. Use that model and come here. Who are we looking at? Let's count the kings of Midian and imagine them sitting around a table. Evi, Rechem, Tzur. Who's sitting in the middle? Tzur, because Tzur is Rosh Umot Beitav. He's the biggest king. And now we find out that it's his daughter who came. That even raises the stakes more. But again, we got to figure out why is Midian the object of this war of vengeance and Moab is getting off scot-free. And again, I mentioned it already, but take a look at source 8, just very quickly. Source 8 is the prohibition of going against Moab, of allowing Moab in. And by the way, in source 7, we're told we're not allowed to go to war against Moab, right? We're not allowed to fight them, and we're not allowed to harass them, right? Their land is not yours. Their land belongs to Bnei, they're part of Bnei Lot. That's where they get land. And why are Moavim not allowed to marry in? For two things. They're not allowed to marry in because they didn't come out and greet you as cousins should in the desert with hospitality, and because they hired Bilam ben Beor to curse you, but not because of this whole whoring incident. It's very hard to understand that. So the only way to really get that is to come back and take a look at the story itself. And as I always teach in class, Yulin shall have it, you cannot understand the Tanakh unless you understand the world of Tanakh. We have to get a grasp of the Zitzim Leben, the Moshav B'chayim, the real world around us when we're talking about this. We're talking about two different nations, Moab and Midian. And the first time that we see Moab and Midian interacting is right here in Source 9, at the beginning of Parshat Balak. What happens? Balak, and I'll just paraphrase, Balak sees that Yisrael has defeated Sihon. They're settling in on the East Bank. There's a huge nation of however many people, over a million certainly, settling in this huge camp with the 12 different sub-camps and everything else. And what happens? Vayago Moab ne'am meod kirav hu. Now, this takes a sensitive reading because the way we've been trained to think about Balak's interest and Bilam's job is one thing, but Pshat doesn't work that way, as you'll see. We think that Balak wants to destroy Am Yisrael and Bilam even more so. That's not the case, at least not here. Moab is afraid. Vayakos Moab ne'am Yisrael. Vayakos means they're sick of them. Vayomer Moab el ziknei Midian. Who does Moab turn to? They turn to Ziknei Midian. Now, we got to take a break for a minute. Who is Moab and who is Midian? So Moab, we know, is a nation that is the fruit of a very disgusting night in a cave with Lot, two daughters, and a bottle of Ripple. And right, conceived in West Virginia, born in Jordan. Right? And Moab, but the nation of Moab and the nation of Ammon are still considered to be quasi-related to Abraham and are given rights and are given their land. They are a land with country, with territory, with a religion, with a culture, with a language. And man, I like them a lot. They're not such great neighbors during Beit Rishon period, but they are neighbors and they have a capital and a king, like a normal nation. On the other hand, who is Midian? So take a look at Source 10. Midian is found in Stei Moab. Source 11, Midianim are walking around the Shomron, and they're the ones who pull Yosef out of the pit. Look at Source 12. Moshe goes to the land of Midian and meets Tzipporah at the well. That's in the middle of the Sinai. Look at in Shoftim Vav, in the story of Gidon. Midian comes and takes over part of the northern part of Israel and controls part of Shevet Menasheh. And their form of fighting is that when we plant, they come in, bring their animals in, and the animals all eat the crops. This is what we call in modern English, terrorism. It's not war, it's terrorism. It's like every time that you want to settle down, we're going to make life impossible for you. And by the way, that reminds us of another nation that we know of who are terrorists, and that is Amalek. Who is Amalek? Amalek is a bunch of different Bedouin tribes, some in the North Sinai, some in the Negev, some who show up in Jordan, and they're part of a larger group called Amalek, but they're sub-tribes, and their modus operandi and modus belli, if you will, is to come and just irritate, hurt, pillage. They're basically pirates. We read that in Shmuel Aleph, Perek Lamed. And Amalek, like Midian, is all over the place. They don't have a city. They don't have a capital. They don't have a king until Agag, and that's when things change. And the same thing with the Midianim. The Midianim are essentially Bedouins, and they're all over the place. Now let's go back to the story. What is Balak's problem? Balak has a problem. He's afraid, and he comes to Ziknei Midian, and he says the following. These people are going to eat up everything around us just like an ox eats all of the fruit. In other words, these people are here and they're going to destroy our resources. They're going to drink all our water, eat all of our crops, and then they're going to move on. In other words, I don't want them here. I don't care what happens to them. I just don't want them here. This is the advice they take, that they counsel with Zikne Midyan. Now, if you're Midyan and you're living in an area and this huge group comes in, it's going to eat the resources, what should you do? Move, do what every Bedouin group does. Get up and move somewhere else. Take those plastic black tents and set them up somewhere else. What's the problem? And instead, Zikne Midyan give them advice. And evidently, because they're part of this, and they go with the elders of Moab the first time to all the way to Bilam. That's an 800-mile track all the way up into northern Syria or southern Turkey to where Bilam is. And they tell them the story. And we're representatives of Balak, and this is what we want. Now, what happens? They come with magics, whatever that may be, and they tell them the story. And what does Bilam say? Stay here tonight. I will tell you what happens, the way that Hashem tells me, and what happens next. Sarei Moab stay with him. You know who disappears from the story? From here to the end? Zikne Midyan. Midyan has no interest. Moab is here for a purely tactical reason, a strategic reason, really. We need to find some way to get these people out of here. And so let them live, let them be happy, but somewhere else. Let them eat somebody else's food and drink somebody else's water. Why is Midyan getting involved? Midyan's getting involved because this is what Midyanim do. Not all Midyanim. We have Yitro, we have Chevra Keni, but that's what these Midyanim do. Am Yisrael is here. Let's see if we can hurt them. Let's see if we can poke at them. Let's see if we can terrorize them. That's what Midyan does. Right? And so therefore, the minute that Bilam says, I'm going to ask Hashem if you'll let me, the Zikne Midyan, who are the ones who really understand magic, they say, that's it, we're out of here. There's no hope for this. And they bug out, and they're never seen again in this story. Zikne Moab, in the meantime, are there on a military mission. They're saying, what kind of military help, what kind of alliance can we build here with Bilam, who's going to help us with it? They come back, and they say, tell Balak that Bilam refuses. He sends bigger delegation. Bilam agrees, and we know how it all plays out. Midyan is not part of the story anymore. And suddenly they show up. Where do they show up? They show up here. Now, let's think about what's happening at the foot of Hare Moab. Bnei Yisrael are living there. And they see the girls of Moab, and it's very interesting, and they're very attractive, and they go after them. And the girls of Moab, one way or another, get them to participate in the worship of the local god, not our main god, Kamosh, the local god, Peor, Hagor, right here. Okay. This is essentially a test for Bnei Israel and a proving ground. What has been the message consistently from Parshat Mishpatim all the way through the end of Dvarim? When you come into the land, you must extirpate all Avodah Zarah and all Ovdei Avodah Zarah. Because if you don't, what will happen? You're going to marry them. You're going to follow their ways, and you're going to abandon me, and you're going to go down the tubes. And here we are sitting for a few months, or however long it is, in the area of Benot Moab, and it happens. And it happens exactly as we're told. First the sexual interest, then the Avodah Zarah. So this, in a sense, drives home the point for Bnei Yisrael what they need to do. And of course, they don't do it, which is why we have a book called Shoftim, which repeats this sort of shenanigans over and over in one form or another. But again, from a perspective of Moab, we understand their position. We're not going to fault them for trying to hurt us. And we're not going to fault them for living there and we go after their girls. We will fault them for not being hospitable. We will fault them for not letting us come through peacefully. And we will fault them for trying to get Bilam to curse us. That okay, and they can't marry in. But we're not going to war against them. They have their territory, we have ours, and we respect the integrity of boundaries. We respect those. But Midyan, why are you getting involved in this? And you're getting so, now here's what happens. The Bnei Yisrael are going after the girls of Moab. All right, that's a tragedy. But Midyan says, oh, I'm going to hop on this bandwagon. I'm going to send not only a girl, I'm going to send a princess. I'm going to send the daughter of the biggest king that we have to go seduce, publicly seduce one of their leaders. That's how we're going to get them. And that's where the Nekama comes in. And who steps forward? Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aharon HaKohen. Because it's his job to bring the schut of Bnei Israel before HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Aharon HaKohen is the one who wears the tzitz and the Choshen and the Kitfei Ephod, they all have the names of Bnei Israel and on top the name of Hashem. It's his job to bring that before HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and it's his job to preserve life. However, when he goes out to war, he's Pinchas ben Elazar, he's doing his job as Mashiach Melchama, that's fine. So what we see here is that in this story, which seems to be a confusion between Moav and Midian, we really have to separate them out. The actions with Benot Moav are our actions. We're liable for that. And what I'd like to suggest that happens here is Hashem says to Moshe, take Rashei Am v'Hokaotam doesn't mean take the leaders and impale them. It means take the leaders and have the leaders impale their own people. The leaders then come and actually come and attack them. And that's the Magifah. That Magifah is going on because there's this tumult going on. And who stops the tumult? Pinchas. Because what changed? Up until now, it was local girls, speakeasy. All right. What happened now is suddenly when it's a Bat Melech Midian, it's a Midianite princess who's there, suddenly everybody sees what's going on. They get it. They realize this was not just an issue of convenience. It had turned into, in the hands of Midian, a spiritual war where they're trying to hurt us and divide us from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's when everything stops. So as soon as Pinchas kills them and demonstrates that act, suddenly the camp goes still. And in that, he's really following in the pattern of his grandfather, Aaron HaKohen, who did the same thing at the end of the Korach episode. He brought the Ketoret out and then it stopped the Magifah. So hopefully with all of this together, we get a better sense of what the story is with Pinchas. Along the way, we talked about why Pinchas gets this brit and why he needs this particular brit. We got a sense of why the relationship between Moav and Midian here, and the Midian's position is one simply of hatred for Bnei Israel and every possible attempt to take us down, whereas Moav is just worried about their own territory and about being able to keep their resources. We're not going to like Moav, but they're neighbors. We got to respect that. Midian, we really hate. Midian, we're after. Midian, we're told to take an act of vengeance, and it's the vengeance of on behalf of Bnei Israel is really the vengeance of HaKadosh Baruch Hu here. So hopefully that gives us a better sense of the entire story and will lead into Parshat Matot when we see the actual war against Midian take place. Again, this year was given in memory of Rav Moshe Farber of Avram Yitzchak HaKohen and my father, Rav Asher Aaron ben Avram Binyamin, whose yahrzeit for both of them is tonight and tomorrow, Chaf Aleph B'Tammuz, Yehi Zichram Baruch.